Good morning, and it is still morning. This is our final WebEx hearing for today, July 8, 2020. Council, well, first of all, I'd be remiss, Ms. Brand, if I didn't congratulate you on your appointment to the bench. That doesn't give you a leg up in connection with this case, but I do want to say congratulations. In connection with the hearings today, each of you should, of course, introduce yourself on behalf of, before you begin your argument. I'll call the next case, file A20-0485, State of Minnesota versus Adam McCoy. And with that said, you'll each have 15 minutes. 5 minutes is additionally reserved for appellate rebuttal if you choose to use that. And Ms. Brand, you have the floor.
Thank you. My name is Janine Brand, Assistant Cass County Attorney, and I represent the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, this is a case in which the respondent, Adam McCoy, made admissions and details about sexual acts allegedly perpetuated upon a two-year-old. And he made those admissions to a probation officer and to a polygraph examiner as part of sex offender treatment for another case in another county. That he did so even after being told that both of them were mandated reporters, and when he was advised that he should not make those admissions about the details that could trigger a report to law enforcement.
Counsel, I preceded his disclosure. What does the record say specifically about the warnings that the probation officer gave prior to his disclosing the incident with the two-year-old, whom I believe he identified, if not by name, by relationship?
When I asked that of Agent Krecklaw, she was not sure exactly when during the conversation that occurred. It did occur during the first conversation she had with him about this disclosure.
So it could have, on this record, occurred after he disclosed it?
That is correct.
Okay, and with respect to the polygraph examiner, like there are two stages. There's the filling out of the victim forms, and then there's the exam. And I know what the record shows relative to the examination, what warnings were given prior to filling out the victim forms. Is there anything on those forms or elsewhere in the record that shows us what he was warned about prior to filling out those forms?
I don't believe that that is part of the record.
Okay.
I guess I know from experience of dealing with CORE that CORE specifically advises individuals not to disclose specifics.
Okay, so we don't have right now a record that tells us when the warnings took place relative to his disclosure on the victim form or relative to his initial disclosure to the probation officer.
The agent could not recall with regard to whether he started to disclose, and then she talked about mandated reporting, or when exactly those words came up.
And you talk about in the brief, but I wanted to get clear on what the state's request is. You talk about this being not, the Fifth Amendment not being an issue that was raised prior to the omnibus, and that it appeared, I think you talk about that in the brief, but you're not, are you asking? So, in other words, that it was sort of a surprise that the district court ruled on the basis of that instead of on the basis of the statute, which was what was in the motion. Is the state asking for a remand? I don't see that in order to address that.
So, I guess my contention is that this is a matter that came before the trial court only on the motion of a 634.03 infringement and whether the facts met fear produced by threats as contained in that statutory language. The parties, none of the parties, and certainly if that had been in the motion to talk about a self-incrimination claim, we could have asked additional questions at the time of the omnibus hearing, but that was never before the court. The defense filed 3 briefs regarding that, never asserted a right of self-incrimination. Yes, we were caught off by that rule.
Okay. So I understand that position, but I don't see in your brief that you're asking for a remand in order to be able to introduce additional testimony, unless I missed it in your brief. And then also, I think from the record below, the district court entertained a motion to reconsider, and I looked at that motion to reconsider, and I don't think there was a request, you know, to be able to reopen the record given the Fifth Amendment issue. So what are you asking for with remand, and are you entitled to it if we thought that it was a surprise issue, given the motion to reconsider and what you've asked for in your brief?
Okay. I didn't seek a remand for relitigating an omnibus issue because that omnibus issue was not presented to the trial court. So the defense had an obligation to bring that challenge and did not do so at the trial court level. That's why I'm not saying let's litigate an issue that the court raised, not the defense. So I was not looking for a remand to relitigate that issue because that issue was never properly presented to the trial court. But if that's what the end result is, I guess my first request is just reverse. The motion before the court was 634.03. That was not addressed by the court. The court invoked a constitutional right that was not invoked by the defendant. And third, relied on case law and the facts are so disparate from the facts of this case, and it is so the Supreme Court here to the United States Supreme Court, that we're at a situation where either we abolish the Murphy decisions with this holding, or we say, hey, look, this is clearly distinguishable. And so, and I just don't see it. We didn't get a chance to talk about the Murphy decision and statements made to probation officers being admissible. We were only talking about whether there was fear or threats, and that's the 634.03 standard. The appellant also believes that the court erred in those three ways. First and foremost, not litigating the motion or not allowing us to litigate the motion or addressing only the motion that was before the trial court. Secondly, invoking a constitutional right on behalf of a defendant in this matter, that the Murphy court clearly says that you can't claim a benefit that you did not invoke. And then third, relying on the two cases, the Johnson versus Fabian cases, with those two defendants, where they were talking about specifically the victims of their current cases. And I still think that that's a distinguishing fact here, that when we talk about did you do what you said you didn't do, or I want you to admit, which is still on appeal, and those people individually invoked their right of self-incrimination, that's wholly different than this matter. This defendant never asserted right against self-incrimination. He never did that. And whereas in the Henderson cases, in the Johnson case, those two defendants did assert that right. And so when it comes to that fact alone, I want it to be clear that if the state wholly believes that if someone asserts a right against self-incrimination, certainly we should not be using that against them. Absolutely. That is the Constitution. I wholeheartedly agree. But those are not the facts of this case. And so when we look
doesn't Murphy in its discussion allow for the possibility that even someone who doesn't raise it, there might be situations in which, I mean, even apart from a custody situation in which the consequences are so severe that it's effectively compelled. And they talk about that, you know, there's almost made it seem unlikely that probation would be revoked in a Murphy case, and there was no history of it and so on in Minnesota, and so made it seem, isn't that a little different from this case, or why wouldn't this be more of a compulsion case than, I guess, than Murphy and what the court was saying about probation there?
I think there are cases that may seem like when there's a, well, let me go to the Johnson finding. The Johnson interpreted that to being and as argued by the defense too, that there's a reason sometimes where that is self-executing. threatening, I guess, in a way. But that has to be shown by a threat implied by the agent that there would be a revocation or a consequence. And so that specific language is included in both the Murphy and the Johnson decisions. And there's no evidence in this case that there was ever a threat of a revocation in this matter. And again, because we didn't litigate that issue, that was not before the trial court. So the third factor, however, is in those distinctions is looking at the Cotton case. The court relied on a 2016 a version of that Cotton case and said it implied that it could be a revocation or a compulsion situation. However, that was rejected by this the Court of Appeals the following year in the 2017 case. What I want to emphasize, however, is the fact that even if this court found that somehow sex offender treatment or trying to be truthful to your agent is compulsory in nature, there are two things. One is there's nothing that compelled him to provide details. And in fact, he was warned, hey, look, don't provide details. We're mandated reporters. This could trigger some additional crimes. And the second thing is, of course, that the difference is that they had no, you know, those individuals were in Johnson were incarcerated. They faced additional incarceration consequences for failing to comply with the polygraph examinations as part of their sex offender treatment.
So, counsel, let's say that this issue had been raised initially prior to the evidentiary hearing. Is it your position that, let's say that, we'll imagine a case where the probation officer said, I didn't warn him not to. In fact, I said, if you don't cooperate, fully write down everything, and I want details, I'm going to write this up as a violation, et cetera. I mean, even if he did not, at that point, invoke his Fifth Amendment right, is it conceivable that, depending on what the officer said, that it could be a case of compulsion?
It could be. When we look at the specific language of Murphy, where it indicates that the implied threat of revocation could be one of those exceptions under Murphy. I think that that's true. But I would also note that revocation, I'm sorry, Judge, I can't hear.
Smith's following up on Judge Smith's question, does it have to be implied or expressed?
The language of the Murphy was implied.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, you know, right. Depending on what you say, if you're on probation and depending on what you do, you could always be revoked. So what, I mean, how does that help us?
That's a difficult situation. Murphy very clearly says the threat of revocation is not compulsory, is not a violation of the right of self-incrimination. So that's the difficult part, is that what is the threat? But again, I'm going back to what is the fear of produced by threats under the 63403 standard. And that's nothing to do with violation of a constitutional right, because that does not equate to fear produced by threats. And that's the problem, you know, that's the problem that we're having in this matter.
What does fear produced by threats in that in the statute mean to you?
Well, that's the difficult part. Are we talking about where someone physically threatens someone? I'm not sure what the statute is implying there. Or are they saying the threats of, you know, I'm going to do something to your spouse? Or does it mean threats of I'm going to report you regarding the drug charge that I've held in my back pocket? I'm not sure. But it can't be, according to Murphy in the United States Supreme Court, the threat of revocation. And I would also state that there's still that next stage. You can file a probation violation report. The court still has to find that it's an intentional and inexcusable reason that you violated probation before probation is revoked. So invoking a constitutional right would not be inexcusable, of course. So I guess I would rely back on the Dressel finding in this matter that there's nothing that was misrepresented to these individuals. They did not assert that the polygraph was admissible or that it was reliable. And so we took a look at the voluntariness, and our record does show that this defendant, Mr. McCoy, did in fact voluntarily engage in conversations with his probation officer, with the polygraph examiner, and on his own chose to provide additional details that then gave rise to these charges. I am asking that the courts, that this court rule that the court, trial court erred in one or all three of those ways and reverse the matter at this time and find that those suppression of his statements was error. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brand. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Johnson, I'm turning to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Zachary Johnson and I represent the respondent in this matter, Adam McCoy. Your Honor, Your Honors, I should, maybe the best place to start, given the discussion up to this point, is the statutory grounds and versus the constitutional grounds. And I would just redirect the court's attention to the Azzone matter, which was cited in my brief, which states that the purpose of 634.03 is to discourage invasions of the constitutional rights of accused persons to be free from undue pressure to confess exerted by law enforcement authorities. And as Judge Halverson stated in his order from February 24th, one of those rights protected by the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions is the right against self-incrimination. And so by bringing the statutory motion, these considerations are incorporated. And the judge so found twice. This issue was resolved in respondents' favor in the initial motion, and then it was relitigated through a motion for reconsideration where that issue was squarely presented to the district court. They did make rulings on that. And so it is properly before this court. The record is not going to get any better for the prosecution on that count. And so remand is a remedy that perhaps would not have any effect on the ultimate outcome because it is a question of law to be decided. Now,
so let's pause there for a moment because your argument is that just by referencing the statute, you basically incorporate among the issues to be considered any constitutional right of an accused person to be free from undue pressure, whether that, I suppose, is, I don't know, it could be 5th or 6th or 14th, whatever amendment it is, and that there could be nothing achieved by a remand. I'm trying to figure out how that figure, is it possible to have a violation of 634.03 in this case without it being a violation of the Fifth Amendment? It seems like they were sort of conflated, that it was about self, and you're even saying, I guess it's like, the issue is the constitutional issue, which is Fifth Amendment, I guess, incorporated into that statute. And how could the record not be improved when we have the Murphy case? What if the record were he was given full warning that, let's even just take a case that he could fully invoke his right, Fifth Amendment right, he didn't have to answer everything, he shouldn't give details, shouldn't give stuff that incriminates him, et cetera. How does it that not change a Fifth Amendment analysis under, especially given Murphy?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that this case is a one where warnings are particularly important, given that if the client or if the defendant refuses to participate in the sex offender treatment, regardless of whether or not he's given warnings, he will be violated. And the record on that is clear. If just to direct the attention to the testimony of Ms. Krecklau, I believe it's on pages 18 and 19 of the hearing transcript, probation agent testifies that if he refuses to engage in the full sexual history that is made to lay the groundwork for the polygraph test, that the consequence will be a probation violation. Now, in this case, it was a stay of adjudication. And so if he's found to have been in violation of his probation, then the stay would be lifted, a felony conviction would be imposed, and all bets are off as far as.
Didn't the officer generally say potentially? That's my recollection of looking at the transcript.
Well,
I'm trying to figure out how this is any different from the court, from the requirement of this sex offender treatment in Murphy, and that it's a condition of probation, et cetera. I mean, why is it different?
Because in Murphy, the court made specific findings that there would have been no adverse consequences if the defendant in that case would have refused to answer the questions. That was a finding on that on the record in that case.
That there would that not have been a notice of violation?
Correct. The court actually makes the finding. It actually is stated in the opinion that there would have been no adverse consequences to the defendant if he would have refused to answer the questions.
Is that in the U.S. Supreme Court or the Minnesota Supreme Court decision that you're referring to?
That is, I believe that's in the U.S. Supreme Court decision. Because I think the history of that case was that it initially was found to be in favor of the criminal defendant in that case in the Minnesota Supreme Court, and then it went up to the United States Supreme Court, and they're the ones who reversed it, and they're the ones who made the finding that there would have been no adverse consequences for the defendant to refuse to answer those questions. This is a different story. That defendant in Murphy, and by the way, I just want to mention the fact that Murphy was not mentioned once at the district court level. And I'll just move on from that, because Judge Halverson was not asked to make any sort of decision based on the invocation of the privilege. And that's probably because it would have seemed absurd for a defendant who is trying to be in compliance with his probation and to achieve the valid rehabilitative goals of the sex offender treatment to all of a sudden say, actually, I'm looking at this as an adversarial proceeding, and I'm going to invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege. That's just not the case. In the Murphy case, the defendant had been on probation, and the facts of that case seemed to be that he was just having a discussion with his probation officer. Some questions were asked about prior conduct, and he answered them. But there's no indication from Murphy that it was one of the conditions of his probation that he submit to questioning or interrogation on the part of the probation officer or the government, and that failure to do so would have resulted in a violation of the probation. Here, we can read from the Register of Actions what the conditions of probation were in that Wadena case, and they were that he must successfully complete the sex offender rehabilitation program. Now, I cannot think of an example of a person who can go through the sex offender rehabilitation program, which is a good thing, and come out of it and say, you know what, I'm not going to talk about any of my past sexual history because that's probably, you know, that could have some adverse consequences against me. And so therefore, I'm going to have the wherewithal to invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. That's not subjectively what a defendant is thinking. They're thinking, I have, the court ordered me to do this, and so I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. I'm going to be truthful. I'm going to make sure I pass that polygraph examination. Now, the state's argument based on Murphy is basically saying that there would have been no consequences for Mr. McCoy had he simply refused to cooperate with probation and engage in that sex offender treatment. And so he could be asked for a complete sexual history and to take a polygraph test to confirm its accuracy, and he could have just said, "No, thank you. I don't think I'll do that. I'll invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination," and that the probation department would have had to accept that answer, and that no ill consequences would have befallen him, and that's just not reality. Again, referring, go back to the transcript, and I think the implication is very clear, even though it may have been tempered by the word possibly. I think before she said possibly, there was some stronger language, but the probation officer said that if he would have done that, he would have been violated on his probation, his stay of adjudication would have been lifted, a felony conviction entered, and a serious sentence imposed. That is the adverse consequence that's discussed in the Johnson versus Murphy case.
Mr. Johnson, I have a hypothetical. Let's say that an individual has been convicted of a crime, he's placed on probation, and the conditions of a probation are, you know, remain law-abiding and don't use any drugs, okay? And obviously, if those are the conditions of probation, and if you don't remain law-abiding and you don't, and if you use drugs, you know, presumably you could be revoked. And so, it's a regular probation meeting, and the probation officer turns to the probationer and says, "So, did you use drugs this weekend?" And go to his house, and, you know, by God, there's meth there, and he's charged with possession of meth. Are you saying that the officer, before he asked him that question, "Did you use drugs this weekend?" would have to have say, "Now, before you answer that question, I want to warn you that anything you say can be used against you, and that you have the right to remain silent, and, you know, you have the right to Fifth Amendment rights." Are you saying that's what has to be, are you saying that was, would have been required in, under that scenario?
No, no, I'm not, Your Honor. And I think that, that.
Why not?
It illustrates the point that this case is not about warnings. It's the act of the drug use that violates the probation in that, in your hypothetical. In this case, it's not, it's the act of refusing to participate in this, in the sex offender treatment is what in fact violates the probation. And so, in your case, the, if the defendant, he's going to be drug tested, refuses to take a drug test, well, then that's going to be part of that, you know, that could be considered to be a violation. But in this case, he can't refuse, my client cannot refuse to participate in the sex offender treatment for that reason. And his participation, or I should say, making these incriminating statements is part and parcel to the sex offender treatment. And there's nothing wrong with that.
So in Judge Connolly's example, you know, where he's obligated to be truthful and answer questions, and he does answer questions and says, "I took meth." You're saying that that statement, that "I took meth this weekend," is admissible in a later criminal proceeding on the meth charge. That's an admissible statement.
Would it be admissible on a new charge of a person possessing methamphetamine?
Yes, the admissibility in a later criminal charge on that charge.
Well, I mean, in this, okay, so possibly because of Murphy, because, but in this case, because the consequence in that case is triggered by the use itself in the hypothetical. So, I don't think that a defendant needs to be necessarily Mirandized every single time that they're in a probation. I don't think that that's what has to be done.
But let's even assume that there's not a Miranda requirement, but there is like a, you don't talk to me, you don't be straight with me about your drug use, I'm going to notice a violation for not answering truthfully. Did you use drugs? Yes, I did. Later used in a criminal trial on drug possession. I mean, I understand the distinction between what you're making between what is the violation, but I'm not exactly sure how that affects the analysis of whether that's compelled testimony under the Fifth Amendment, why it's different.
Well, I mean, I think that a distinction here also would be that the fact that we have a polygraph and that the defendant is expected to answer questions honestly. In the case of the methamphetamine use, the person.
But I mean, the polygraph.
I think the judge is muted. I can't hear.
Yes, the answers. I mean, the answers to the polygraph test, whatever they are, could not be used against him in, you know, in a new trial for him being charged with, you know, having sex with minors. I mean, am I wrong on that?
Well, I think that's the question in this case. I think that that is, I think that's
when
precisely.
Have we ever let polygraph answers be admitted in any criminal trial in the history of the state?
Well, it's not the assessment or the analysis of the answers. In other words, not the the polygrapher's expert testimony as to the truth of the statement that that they would seek to admit. They would seek to admit the statements themselves as admissions. I think
right.
That
not the results of whether they were of the polygraph, but what he said is what's that issue. Should have asked this earlier, both his victim form that he filled out and the statements that he made in his polygraph relative to the polygraph test.
The statements that were made to the probation officer and the polygrapher are what's at issue.
Okay. And potentially the victim form that he filled out or not?
Potentially, yes. But I think that the victim form, if I may just continue to answer the question, the victim form, I believe would simply provide identifying information that could link the statement that was made to the probation officer to a real person. And so I don't think there were any incriminating admissions in the victim information form itself. So unless there are any further questions, I'll rest on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brand, I have a question for you. Doesn't a defendant's confession require some independent corroboration? You're muted, just so you know.
I'm sorry. And Judge, you cut out there for a second at the beginning of your question.
Well, my question to you as a prosecutor is, doesn't a defendant's admission to a crime require some independent corroboration to verify the admission?
Yes, it does under our law. And even though the defense argued and even though the court was concerned about it, there is evidence that was presented to the trial court in this matter, and that the trial court said that he was not going to address the corroboration issue in light of his ruling on the self-incrimination claim.
So the discussion we're having as far as use of the polygraph examination in a defendant uttering something, saying something, confessing something, whether it's true or not, we agree the polygrapher's testimony isn't admissible, but isn't that the same as far as the admission, unless there's something else to corroborate?
So the admissions made, well, that is true. You have to corroborate. And in this case, we know that there was a person based on his disclosure of his relationship to that child. We know where that child was living at the time, how old that child was, what the age difference was of that child, and corroborated the relationship through the mother in this case. And then some behavior that exhibited from that child thereafter. So certainly that is required in light of the 634.03 ruling. But the trial court never even got to that position. I do want to address a couple other things. There is a reliance here on the zone statement about law enforcement authorities here. And here we have a probation officer who is not a peace officer. And we have a polygraph examiner who does not work for the state of Minnesota. He's an independent contractor. And so when we talk about undue influence, we're not talking about a law enforcement authority. These people do not wear guns. They do not have arrest powers. That is the concerning here. Secondly, I want to clarify that the testimony of Agent Krecklaw was, in fact, the word potentially could cause revocation. The Murphy court also said that every fifth grader knows the right about self-incrimination. And so I'm not saying that every person does, in fact, know, but their contention is people know their rights. And McCoy was an individual who just got off of being advised and being represented by an attorney during the entire Wadena case and knew his constitutional rights, did not invoke them in this matter. I would also note that the process of sex offender treatment and the full disclosure of sexual history does not trigger incriminating statements unto themselves. This defendant could have gone into court, or could have gone into his agent and said, yep, there was a 2-year-old uncharged victim. And he would have been completely truthful and in compliance. He could have gone to the polygraph examiner and been in, and said, this, I had a 2-year-old child victim, and this is my relationship to that child. But it was because he chose to provide the additional details.
Ms. Brandt, does the record indicate does the record indicate in terms of the probation policies in the corrections department up in, you know, wherever you are, Cass County, indicate that if he had said, you know, I am invoking my first Fifth Amendment rights, I'm not going to answer that question. Does the record indicate that by doing that, he would have been revoked for not complying with the, you know, sex offender protocol?
The record does not indicate that one way or the other. This is a Wadena County probation, but we didn't litigate that issue. And those were not the cross-examination questions that were asked by Mr. Johnson in this matter. You look at page 18 and on to 19 in that transcript, he didn't ask about refusal to ask questions. He asked about failing to cooperate with the polygraph, which could entail that, but on the other hand, did not. And so we don't have a record regarding the self-incrimination claim. I want to add just a couple more statements here. One is that basically, if we don't allow probation officers to engage in this activity, then we are cutting off one of their monitoring, they're holding people accountable, and their rehabilitative process. That is all the part of a probation officer. And basically,
officer, time has expired. If you want to wrap it up, please.
I will do so. So again, I just want to point out that there was nothing that compelled Mr. McCoy to add those details. He chose to do so. The record that we do have shows that he voluntarily provided that information to the two individuals in this matter that gave rise to the charges. And I'd ask again that the court reverse the trial court's orders. Thank you.
To both lawyers for appearing today via WebEx, we appreciate that. As far as our court system is right now, this is an interesting chicken or egg case, and we will take it under advisement. A decision will be issued within the 90 statutory period. With that said, the attorneys can leave the room, and judges, we will likewise leave and confer after this hearing.